What do you love about music?
To begin with, everything.
Now, this is serious business here, man. We've got a mission. Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Welcome to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Tonight on the world's only rock and roll talk show, the man killed our music, folks.
Record labels screwing the artists over and refusing to release albums that they've recorded.
Also, we're going to have a review of one of the biggest albums in America right now. It happens to be from an artist who has been dead for nearly a decade. This isn't the first time this has happened, and we're going to
give
you
be the, last.
The whole history of this phenomenon.
Plus, I'll have a Desert Island jukebox. But first, as always, we've got some music news. What you're hearing bubbling under there is a track called Galang by an artist called M.I.A. M.I.A. is a East Asian woman who grew up in England and kind of forged this sound that's half hip-hop, half dance. And according to 795 critics that were polled by the Village Voice for their annual Paz and Jop poll, 32nd year this has been going on, the number two album of the year, behind Kanye West's Late Registration as the number one album of the year. We wanted to talk a little bit about the similarities and the differences, more importantly, between the Village Voice's Paz and Jop poll and the Grammys, which are coming up next week. And we're going to give some predictions on the top categories in the Grammys. But, Greg, what the heck is this Village Voice poll?
Well, it's an annual poll, 32nd or 33rd year. They haven't quite kept track.
They couldn't figure out if they did it right the first year or not. I don't know.
Exactly. The longest-running critics poll in America for rock music.
And the most thorough.
Indeed.
Despite the fact that, for some reason, I guess my ballot got lost in the mail this year. They didn't count me. So it would have been 796 critics.
A huge oversight. But they poll everybody from daily newspaper critics like yourself and myself, magazine critics, to writers at fanzines, internet magazines.
Yeah.
Anybody who writes about rock music is welcome to sign in on the critics poll. And inevitably, we have the critics' favorites for each year. You can look back on this poll. They're at villagevoice.com. You can look back and see who the critics liked and touted year to year, and then compare it to what the Grammys touted year to year.
Yeah, the Village Voice traditionally puts the poll out right around Grammy time. Because if you go back and look at the sad history, the Grammys were established in the mid-50s when rock and roll was at its height. You had some of the greatest rock artists ever charting this whole art form. Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Chuck Berry. And who were the big nominees in year one? It was Mitch Mitchell and Doris Day and artists like this. It was formulated by Frank Sinatra, actually, and a bunch of his cronies to honor excellence in music, which they saw as anything that wasn't rock and roll.
Yeah.
So the Grammys throughout their history have been at least 10, sometimes 20 years behind the curve. The Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan, for example, never honored with Grammys during the 1960s. You know, the Grammys have been getting better because it's a younger membership coming into the Recording Academy. But still, I think if you compare the lists, the Paz and Jop Critics Poll list with the Grammys, Paz and Jop always wins. And so the Village Voice, here's according to 795, or if you factor me in, 796 critics this year, the albums of the year. Kanye West at number one, M.I.A. at number two, Sufjan Stevens at number three, Sleater-Kinney at number four, Fiona Apple, who we're actually going to talk about a little later, at number five, The White Stripes, Anthony and the Johnsons, The Hold Steady, The New Pornographers, and My Morning Jacket.
Now, it's interesting. If you look at just say that top six, three of those names, including the number two, three, and four albums of the year, according to the critics of America, aren't even nominated for Grammy Awards this year. The key common ground here Number one is Kanye West in the Critics Poll, and it is nominated. Kanye West's record, Late Registration, is nominated for 8 Grammys this year. So it's interesting that on the top album, we may see some confluence of opinion here.
And, you know, I only have the top 20 here, but nowhere in sight in the top 20 for the Critics of America is Mariah Carey. And yet, you know, she has 8 nominations as well, tying with Kanye West in the Grammys. You know,
Mariah Carey.
I don't know.
The thing is, there's this storyline that the record industry is putting out this year, that Mariah Carey had a comeback, quote-unquote.
Now, if you recall, a couple of years ago, she was reduced to these kind of journal entries. I'm going crazy. I can't leave my room. And actually, she did some audio recordings that she posted on her website. She was basically melting down in public.
In the wake of that Glitter movie, which got terrible reviews. And the New York Times had a front-page piece basically saying Mariah Carey's career is over. Her record company bought her out, basically said, go find another home. We're going to pay you
millions of dollars
to go away.
To leave. How do we get that? How do we get that kind of offer? So they're looking for a comeback. They want to coronate Mariah Carey.
You know, I've got to cover these as you do, and you're already depressing me. I mean, it's
3 or 4 days
away, and I'm already depressed.
Well, the show is, 3.5 hours going on 17 hours long. You know, you get to look forward to such highlights as the president of the Recording Academy telling people not to download music. And it's such a cliche and so pathetic. Although just today, they announced one more roster of performers. Last couple of years, the Grammy show has decided that if we put unlikely performers together, that's really interesting. So Madonna is going to perform with Gorillaz.
Wow.
Now, Gorillaz, if you don't know, is a cartoon rock band that doesn't really exist. When they toured behind their first album, the musicians played behind a screen, and it was the cartoons that were shown on stage.
So Madonna's going to perform with a bunch of cartoons.
I don't know what that means. Many people would say Madonna has been a cartoon throughout her career. We got some more news. That is a song called I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor, which is a runaway smash super hit on the British charts right now by a band called Arctic Monkeys. Young kids playing this hyped up, ultra energetic English dance music, and they have made history on the British pop charts. When Arctic Monkeys' debut album, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, was released in mid-January, it became the fastest-selling debut album in British chart history, shooting right to number one with sales of 360,000 copies, just becoming this phenomenon. Apparently, the entire island nation across the ocean is crazy about Arctic Monkeys.
They're in a tizzy, Jim. They're in a tizzy. That's the word for it. The NME, which is one of the longest-running and most respected music magazines in England, just named this debut album by this up-till-now unknown band, the Arctic Monkeys, as the 5th best album ever in UK music history, ahead of The Clash's London Calling and The Beatles' Revolver.
That's amazing. This is not new. We're going to talk about the Arctic Monkeys specifically and take a look at this album, give it a review. But this is not a new phenomenon. A lot of times I get emails from readers and listeners that say, you know, you rock critics, you're obsessed with the new. But I don't know who the heck these bands are you're writing about half the time. I've never heard of them. You think it's a problem with we American rock critics, it is insane in England where, you know, they seize upon the band of the moment and they say stuff like this young band of 19-year-olds have made the 5th best album of all time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the big test for the Arctic Monkeys is, okay, big in England, but is it going to mean anything in North America? And there is a laundry list of UK bands that were significant hits, not just, you know, one-week wonders hyped by the British press.
Chart-topping. You know, previously, you know, breaking records like the Arctic Monkeys have just done.
Right.
But it never moves across the ocean or really, you know, the other direction. Europe doesn't care either.
Right.
You know, only the English Isles seem to be concerned.
And it's not to say that these are unworthy bands. It's just that they didn't mean nearly as much in the United States as they did in the UK. think about The Jam, the band called The Jam, led by one Paul Weller, basically had a lifespan from the early 70s through the early 80s, 73 through 82. Weller had this band, Mod Meets Punk Sound, that just took over England for a number of years, had hit after hit after hit in the UK,
yeah,
and didn't mean a thing in the United
and
States.
And were actually a great band.
Two lovers kissing must scream up at night. Two lovers missing the tranquility of solitude. Getting a cabman, traveling on buses. Reading the graffiti up a slash seat of bears. That's the deluxe entertainment. That's entertainment.
The other funny list recently was The Guardian, which I think does some of the best mainstream newspaper criticism, mm-hmm, in the UK. They put out a list of the 10 most important bands in the UK today. At number one is a band that has been mentioned just as a footnote in American gossip columns because the leader, or the ex-leader, I guess, dated Kate Moss, the supermodel who's, you know, in a bit of trouble. The Libertines.
Right.
Who, you know, what, why? That's the number one important band in England today, according to The Guardian.
Yeah.
What a waste, what a big waste. You pissed it all off the wall. Round the corner where they chase, to there's tears coming out from every wall. The city's hard, the city's fair. Get back inside. You've got nothing on now. Why are you bleeding on me? Two bucks.
Two records produced by Mick Jones of The Clash. Again, a band that meant everything in England and is virtually meaningless in the United States. Very close to that category. Think about a band like The Smiths. Mm. You know, a band that just took over England for about 5 years, 1982 through about 87, when Morrissey split off with his bandmates, never to return. He and Johnny Marr, kind of the two linchpins of that band. The Smiths had countless number one singles and albums in the UK and never had a top 40 song in the US.
So number one in the UK and can't even crack
couldn't even
the
get
top
the top 40.
40
in the US.
Sweetness, sweetness, I was only joking when I said I'd like to mash a tree tooth in your head.
I got a theory, as I often have. I think since the British invasion, we've just been having the last laugh, you know, and we are very discerning on these shores ever since in what we're going to embrace from the motherland.
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of factors here. Think about the British invasion that you spoke of in the 60s, the Beatles, the Stones, later on the Who, the Kinks, those kind of bands coming through here. I think a lot of ways, and Lennon said it, we're just giving back the music that America started.
Yeah.
They were blues and R&B-based bands that basically took that music and did their own version. So America sort of understood this music. It was just a bunch of white guys from England doing their version of it. Similarly, in the early 80s, you had those pop bands in England, the second British invasion, really, led by, you know, people like Human League.
And, Culture Club.
And yeah, Culture Club and Eurythmics. Those bands actually had quite a bit of success in the U.S. doing kind of a straightforward pop songs. I think now one of the difficulties with the translation here is that, you know, the very Englishness of these bands is sort of hurting them. They're very much talking about subject matter that only somebody living in England would really know about. I mean, you think about a band like Blur.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no more English band than Blur.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you. I'm going to disagree with you about that. I think that sometimes we love Englishness, and in fact, my Desert Island Jukebox pick later in the show is going to be that. But let's get back to the Arctic Monkeys. Let's hear the second single that's primed to set the UK crazy, mm-hmm, and maybe, you know, the album comes out February 21 in America. This is called When the Sun Goes Down. Let's play this, and when we come back, we're going to give our thoughts about this band.
I said, who's that girl there? I wonder what went wrong so that she had to roam the streets. She doesn't do major credit cards, I doubt she does receipts. It's all not quite legitimate. And what a scummy man. Just give him half a chance, I bet he'll rob you if he can. Can see it in his eyes, yeah, that he's got a driving ban amongst some other offences. And I've seen him with girls of the night, and he told Roxanne to put on her red light.
They're all infected, but he'll be alright, 'cause he's a scumbag, don't you know? I said he's a scumbag, don't you know? I'm sorry, love, I'll have to turn you down. Oh, we must be up to summer. What are the chances? Sure, it's more than likely. I've got a feeling in my stomach. I start to wonder what your story might be. What your story might be. Yeah, 'cause they said it changes when the sun goes down. Yeah, they said it changes when the sun goes down. And they said it changes when the sun goes down. Around here. Around.
All right, there are the Arctic Monkeys. Again, I said that these guys are 19 years old. They have an interesting sense of history. Some of the heroes that they cite are the White Stripes, Americans, and the Vines. At 19, they're too young to have known about this band, Nirvana. So they're emulating the Vines, which are a horrible third-generation Nirvana ripoff. But the biggest influence, I think, on this music, Greg, is the Strokes, who were in the studio here a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. The Arctic Monkeys are just throwing in these kind of Strokes riffs, you know, this kind of New York punk attitude paired with the English dance groove, and passing it off as something original. And I dig it, but boy, they're not reinventing the wheel.
You know, I feel sad for these guys because I think the hype is so, you know, tumultuous around these guys that they can't possibly get a fair shake. I mean, there's going to be people who love it because of the hype. And then there's people like us who are going to be very skeptical of it. I think this kid, Alex Turner, who just turned 20, reminds me a lot of Mike Skinner of the Streets. He's talking about the daily rituals, the very mundane rituals of these kids on the dole in England. And I believe him. He's kind of a truthful storyteller. He's not talking about save the world, end of the world, oh, woe is me. He's talking about flirting with girls on the dance floor. He's talking about baiting cops outside the club.
Yeah.
He's talking about a long Saturday night, you know, with nothing to do.
Well, and like the young punk that he is taking such joyful glee in taking the piss out, as the English would say, on somebody that he considers a scumbag. Certainly, this is a band that's going to be one to watch. I think they could possibly develop into something really, really interesting. And I would say this is a buy it record. I really would. But, you know, I mean, they're not the second coming.
No, not by any stretch. Turner's a funny guy. More disappointingly, I think the record over the course runs its course. I mean, it's guitar, bass, and drums, and they're kind of shaky. They're a decent band. The drummer's got some nice little hooks and fills in there. But in terms of the Sonics, I just find it kind of peters out long before the record is done.
So on this patented Sound Opinions rating scale, I said buy it.
I'm going to say burn it. I think there's some good tracks on here. It's not a great record by any stretch. Who knows? This band is very, very young, and they could end up turning into a great band, but they're not there yet.
That is, Greg, if they don't get drowned by the hype, or even worse, if the record company doesn't screw them over. When we come back, we're going to look at The Man Killed Our Music, albums that artists recorded but the record companies torpedoed. And there's a couple of news pegs, a couple of real recent cases of that happening. We're going to also look at the history on Sound Opinions.
We'll be right back. gonna skip a beat. Think it over. Walk into the corner store, but it ain't there no more. If you want a loaf of bread, you try a pharmacy instead. Another chain will set you free.
That is Nellie McKay from a record called Pretty Little Head that you will not be hearing on the Sony Corporation. Sony Corporation was scheduled to put that record out in the first week in January and said, nope, don't think so.
So, in fact, you got an advance release as a critic.
Yes.
Was on the calendar. It was supposed to be coming out as a Sony release. And they pulled the record from distribution. And Nelly has posted on her website outrage at this, right?
Oh, yeah. This is, it shouldn't come as any surprise that a major label is telling an artist, No, we don't want to put your record out. But this was kind of a last-minute pull-the-plug decision. The conflict here was essentially one of how long is this album going to be? Nellie McKay had put out a debut record in 2004 that was very well received. Get Away From Me was the name of the record. It sold a little over 100,000 copies. Not a huge success, certainly by commercial standards on a major label, but critically well acclaimed, and a lot of anticipation for the second record. She wanted to put out a 23-song 65-minute version of Pretty Little Head. Columbia wanted to put out a 16-song, 48-minute version. Nellie basically said, take it or leave it. If this is the music business, I want out, she said, challenging Columbia/Sony to put out the full-length version of the record.
You've heard the whole album, and I haven't. Is any of it better than that? Because I don't know if I would have felt sorry for Sony Columbia. That was a pretty crappy song.
A little taste of it. Generously put, she's a quirky artist. You know, there's a cross here between hip-hop and Broadway and cabaret. There's a little bit of shtick here, of theatricality. She's also very sarcastic and witty songwriter. I mean, there's some really sharp turns of phrase
on
this
record. So you could argue that the record company thought that such quirkiness was better served in a short dose rather than a long dose.
And they may well be right. I don't think they saw this artist in this day and age, unless you're selling a million copies of a record, the major labels really aren't interested in you. And they basically told Nellie McKay to take a hike. Now, the bad news for the artist in this case is that the record company usually owns the master tapes of the finished record. In other words, they can decide when and where to put it out. And if the artist wants to put that record out, which they had made, they need to pay the record company to get those tapes back.
They're hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And you can't buy yourself out a hock. It's kind of like being indebted to a loan shark.
Right.
You know, my mafiosa New Jersey pass.
Exactly.
You can't get beyond that vigorish.
Many, many major label records stuck in the vaults that have never been released.
Well, you said it. This is not a new thing. As long as there have been major labels, there have been executives deciding that they know better than the artist and holding the albums back. So this got us thinking about the history. We thought we would delve into our collections and come up with a couple of examples each.
There's a history of lost classics, Jim. There's no doubt about it. There's albums that were stuck in the vaults that probably shouldn't have. And it's not to say, oh, the big bad major labels, they don't know what they're doing. But there have been instances where the artists have been screwed by their label.
There's been instances also where albums probably didn't deserve to come out. That's what I'm saying.
Exactly.
When you say lost classics, we could go on about tons of great albums that the artist had a change of heart and pulled back.
Right.
Something like Prince's Black album, let's say. He decided not to put that out. It wasn't necessarily a company thing, but we decided to keep this list. We'll have to save that other thing for another show. We'll keep this list to albums that the record company basically pulled the plug on.
Right.
Now we've cleared the southern tip of South America, and we're coming in along into Australia and over the New Zealand area.
All right, my first example is an album by the immortal Butthole Surfers. That's Gibby Haynes, leader of the band, pretending to be an astronaut, floating over Earth and giving commentary about what he's seeing. Second time on Chicago Public Radio we've played the Buttholes. Last time we played them for Donovan.
Wow.
How about that?
The Buttholes resurrection starts here.
This is a classic example. You know, there was a 15-minute window, circa 1991, after Nirvana sold 8.5 million copies in a couple of weeks of Nevermind, when all the major labels decided anything that is even remotely alternative rock, we are going to snatch up. And somehow the Butthole Surfers wound up signed to Capitol Records, you know, the label that brought us, you know, Frank Sinatra and the Beatles, for God's sake.
Right.
Then alternative
kind of waned, right? You know,
yes.
Post-Nirvana, post-Lollapalooza, this music wasn't selling anymore. The Butthole Surfers just kept making Butthole Surfers records, and they made a pretty good one. It was the first one that they really did digitally on computers. It was to be called After the Astronaut. And Capitol Records heard this and said, it's too weird. You know, we don't want to put this out. This is 1998. Why did you ever sign the Butthole Surfers if you didn't expect to get weird albums from them? That's what they do.
They got a hit out of the Butthole Surfers.
The thing. They had a hit with Pepper.
I don't mind the sun sometimes, the images it shows. I can taste you on my lips and smell you in my clothes. Cinnamon and sugary and softly spoken lies. You never know just how you look through other people's eyes.
They wanted more of that, and instead the Buttholes just kept making Butthole albums. And then Capitol freaked out. So the Buttholes sued Capitol and said, wait a minute, you can't say that you're not going to release this. If you do say that, we demand an early release from our contract. Capitol was happy to let them go. But that record, as it was originally recorded after the Astronaut, Capitol retained the rights and it never came out.
Mm-hmm.
The Buttholes had their revenge by re-recording most of it. In fact, that song we heard, Last Astronaut, is from the new version of the album called The Weird Revolution, which eventually came out on Hollywood Records, which was owned by Disney.
Right.
Apparently, they didn't get the memo that the Buttholes were too weird for public consumption.
Seems like
there's a magazine called Sunset and a tape machine that won't let me ever forget this impossible longing for you.
There was a classic example of this recently, Jim, with Wilco's Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
You wrote about a book about this, didn't
you? Much celebrated in the press, yes, and I am complicit in that. Yankee Hotel Foxtrot was scheduled to come out in 2001 in Reprise Records. It didn't actually come out until 2002 on Nonesuch Records, another subsidiary of Warner Brothers. The reason it did not come out is because of songs like the one we're hearing, magazine called Sunset. One of the songs originally scheduled to be on that record. Reprise Records was looking for songs like this, more pop-oriented type of singles. But Jeff Tweedy, the songwriter and visionary of the band, you know, was looking at more of a conceptual work where the songs really fit together. Certain more pop-oriented songs, like Magazine Called Sunset, were sort of filtered out of the record, and he wanted to look at this as sort of a bigger-picture album that worked with a beginning, middle, and end, all the songs working together.
Well, that's the way an artist would say it. The way the record company would say it is, but we don't hear a hit.
We don't hear a hit, and that's exactly what Reprise told him. We don't hear any singles on this record. Jeff, could you try again? Tweedy basically said, no, I don't want to try again. Mm. This is the record. I'm done with this record now. They came to Loggerheads, and basically Reprise said, well, we'll put this out, but we're not really that enthusiastic about it. And Wilco heard them loud and clear, basically saying, this record is going to die if Reprise puts it out. They mm-hmm. had a much more faith in the record than the record company did. Reprise let him go. And we'd mentioned earlier that artists normally have to pay to get their master tapes back. But Reprise, in this case, was somewhat embarrassed by this because Wilco, by then, had developed a pretty strong reputation nationwide and worldwide, really, as a significant band. So Reprise gave them back the tapes to Yankee
for
Hotel
free.
Foxtrot. What a coup for the band. They were able to shop the record themselves and put it out. And it worked out tremendously for Wilco because when they did finally put out Yankee Hotel Foxtrot the next year, without Magazine Called Sunset on it, exactly the way they had originally envisioned the record, it ended up becoming the biggest selling record of their career.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back.
That's a little bit of a song called I Fall Up by Brian Eno from an album that was called My Squelchy Life, an interesting 1991 disc that never came out. This story is partly Big Bad Record Company and partly petulant or peevish artist. Yeah. Eno had returned to singing after being away from it for 15 or 20 years with a great record that he made with John Cale called Wrong Way Up. And then this was going to be his first solo album with vocals proper. And he recorded it in a kind of scattershot method as he crossed America, playing in different studios, in different places, different times, with different people. Weirdly divergent rhythm section. You know, Michael Jackson's rhythm section paired with Benmont Tench and some of the Neville brothers.
Wow.
Benmont from Tom Petty's band. Weird combinations of people. It was an interesting record. He wanted to put it out in September of 91. And the record company said, well, you know, it's an interesting record, a little weird. We don't think it's going to get much attention in September. You should put it out in February of 92. And he said, no, it's now or never. I'll put it out today, but by February I'll have moved on. It'll be different stuff. I'll put out a different record in February. And they said, well, this is when we have time for it, buddy. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of My Squelchy Life. So it never came out in that form. So I would say that's half record company.
These things tend to, well, once you dig into them a little deeper, you realize that the artists are somewhat complicit. You know, the Nellie McKay story is a good example. I mean, Nellie McKay pushed and pushed her record label until they finally said, enough! We're not going to put the damn thing out. And the same thing happened here, it seems like, with Eno.
My theory about this next one you're going to talk about is that the artist did have some role in this.
Absolutely. Fiona Apple, we're talking about an album that was made twice before it actually came out, called Extraordinary Machine. Fiona is a famously eccentric artist. She is not a woman who takes herself lightly, or anything else lightly, for that matter.
A little high-strung.
A little high-strung, to say the least. And went into the studio with her longtime collaborator, John Bryan, in California to make the third record of her career. She had sold 3 million copies of her previous two albums combined. The record company was sort of monitoring the progress of the album and not really liking what they heard. Complex songs, complex arrangements. John Bryan, the man who collaborated with Kanye West on his most recent success, is a man who knows his way around a studio. He can play many instruments. He's conducted symphony orchestras, arranged string parts for a number of major label records. This record was as much about John Bryan as it was Fiona Apple. I think Fiona herself even thought that, realizing the record wasn't really done yet to her satisfaction. She wanted to keep working on it. And what she thought she heard from the major label was, well, if you want to spend any more money on this record, we're going to have to approve a track at a time and allow you to record a track at a time before we will allow you to continue recording this
record.
You
say that's what she thought she heard.
She thought she heard that. So essentially what Fiona Apple did was quit the music business. She basically walked away for about a year, stopped recording altogether, and had no intention of ever recording again with Extraordinary Machine in the can, essentially unfinished. Fiona Apple and John Bryan did not want this record out there. Nonetheless, I have to say, the stuff that did surface, I thought was terrific stuff, and her fans loved it as well.
Mm-hmm.
They thought, why is this record sitting in limbo? Why can't we hear this music? Why won't Epic Records officially release this music? Well, this didn't move Epic Records much, but it did motivate Fiona Apple to start working on the record again. This time she went back in the studio with a couple of producers named Mike Elizondo and Brian Cahue, and re-recorded Extraordinary Machine. One of the most amazing examples of the difference between the two records is the song Red, 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 which you heard earlier in the John Bryan incarnation, the very dramatic string arrangements. Now you hear a more muted, more stripped-down version from the Mike Elizondo, Brian Cahue version that officially surfaced last fall on Epic Records.
Understand about complementary colors and what they say. Side by side they both get right, together they both get great. But he's been pretty much shallow, and I've been kind of blue. But all I can see is red, 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 red now. What am I gonna do?
A case of a record taking 6 years to finally surface, and now there's two competing versions of it out there.
Well, we could go on playing this game forever, Greg. It's endlessly fun. Just a few of countless other many examples of record companies apparently pulling the plug on artists. Sheryl Crow had a record early in her career that never came out. John Fogerty's had a number of them. Cheap Trick, I think, once was subject to it. The Bee Gees in their career when they were changing around. Neil Young has like 5 or 6
oh my God.
Records that have never...
I mean, Geffen sued him for making unrepresentative albums in the 80s, whatever that means, and didn't release a bunch of his stuff.
But I think we wrap up this story of The Man Killed Our Music with probably the best album ever that a boneheaded record company didn't want to put out. This is a song from it called Foggy Notion.
She's over by the corner, got her hands by her side.
Now sort of universally recognized as one of the most influential bands in rock history, the Velvet Underground, Sad But True was sent packing from MGM Records. They had recorded 3 albums, and this music was supposed to be...
Sold about seven copies.
But everyone who bought one, and Brian Eno's famous quote, everybody who bought a Velvet Underground album went out and started a band. They had made 3 albums. They had recorded a 4th. It was scheduled to come out on MGM Records. MGM decided, no thanks. Not good enough. We're not going to put this out. And the band went over to Atlantic Records, made 1 final album, Loaded, the one that included Sweet Jane, and then they broke up. Many of the songs that they recorded for this Great Lost Velvets album in 1968 and 69 eventually surfaced years later on PolyGram, still part of the MGM family. The corporation retains the rights to these things.
Yes, they did.
As 2 different compilations called VU and Another View. But there could have been 5 Velvet Underground albums instead of 4.
They did eventually recognize 20 years later, hey, these guys are kind of important. They kind of influenced all kinds of music, and maybe we'll put this out now and maybe make some money off it, which they in fact did. I mean, the Velvet Underground catalog continues to sell, so they stuck it to the man, so to speak. The man stuck
the
it
man
to them,
stuck
but
it
they
to
ended
them.
Up sticking it to the man after...
There's a lesson here for Nellie Mackay and Fiona Apple and all the other troubled artistes of the world. If you stick around long enough and persevere and believe in your vision, you may eventually be able to stick it back to the man.
If you need a little bit of a background on this stuff, don't listen to us. Go right to soundopinions.com and look at the footnotes.
Well,
because
at least not until we do the spin-off book.
Yeah, exactly.
No, the coffee table book companion to the Sound Opinion show.
But the footnotes are terrific, and we have nothing to do with those, Jim. Our crack staff here, Robin Lynn, Jason Saldana, does this every week. Amazing footnotes at soundopinions.com that will explain and deepen your understanding of everything we've talked about in
And for that
show.
Matter, the message board at soundopinions.com. If you're an aggrieved record company exec and you want to have your 2 cents, I mean, I'm feeling for the Nellie Mackay guy, because I wouldn't have wanted the executive to put that record out.
Rocking a Hard Place kind of deal for
yeah.
him?
Yeah. Not that I cry much for record company executives, but nevertheless, we are always open for alternate views on Sound Opinions, and you can post there or call into the hotline. It's free. 888-859-1800. You're listening to Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. Coming up in the show, we're going to talk about the chart-topping album by the Notorious B.I.G. and the entire concept of posthumous releases by artists who are no longer with us. Plus, I'll have a Desert Island Jukebox pick.
I got it.
When I die, I wanna go to hell. Cause I'm a piece of ish, it ain't hard to tell. All my life I've been considered as the worst. Lying to my mother, even stealing out of purse. Crime after crime, from drugs to extortion. I know my mother wish she got a f***ing abortion.
That is a song called Hold Ya Head by the Notorious B.I.G. Not really by him, because he's dead several years now since his shooting death in Los Angeles in 1997. But it's on this new album, the Notorious B.I.G. Duets. And you'll notice it's built on a sample of Johnny Was by Bob Marley. So you have not one, but two dead icons for the price of one.
This dead icon business, I mean, death is a great, great career move, as countless artists have proven through history.
Well, the famous Rolling Stone cover, Jim Morrison, he's hot, he's sexy, he's dead.
Yes, Notorious B.I.G., a.k.a. Biggie Smalls, a.k.a. Christopher Wallace, as his mom called him once or twice, I'm sure, has been dead since 1997. He was shot to death in Los Angeles. And 3 weeks before his second album was about to come out, the presciently titled Life After Death. And you talk about a life after death. Biggie actually managed to release only one studio album in his actual lifetime, Ready to Die in 1994.
Clearly a morbid man from
birth. This man was obsessed with certain things.
He was obsessed with it. But the second album was finished. It came out after his death.
Right.
And because of that, it did huge commercial business.
Huge business. This guy sold tens of millions of records over his career. And then there was a third record that came out in 99.
And that was kind of culled from what was left on the cutting room floors. You know, Biggie was considered part of the feud that also took Tupac Shakur's life. Mm-hmm. The difference is Tupac recorded prolifically throughout his career, and there's been several, I think it's up to three or four or five posthumous Tupac releases, but Biggie, they haven't had anything. He was lazy. He made the two albums, had a little bit left over for Born Again. What are they doing on the Notorious B.I.G. duets? They're going back to the three albums. They're taking well-known lyrics that he recorded. They're removing the music, putting new musical tracks on, and pairing him up with an endless list of cameos and a veritable who's who of the hip-hop and R&B world.
Right, right. It's an incredibly transparent attempt to keep the franchise rolling. With basically nothing left in the vaults, let's put on this A-list of rappers, including the people who succeeded him in the New York City scene. I mean, the big impact of Biggie Smalls was that he was the guy credited with single-handedly bringing New York City back into the forefront of the rap world. You remember in the late 80s, early 90s, West Coast rap was all the rage. Well, Biggie Smalls brought New York City back. And then he was gone. So the successors, Jay-Z, Nas, they're all on this record. Jim, how many hip-hop concerts have we been to in the last decade where Biggie Smalls was not mentioned?
It's amazing. There's always the obligatory moment.
Have to have it.
You give the shout-out to Pac, you give the shout-out to Biggie, you give the shout-out to Aaliyah. Imagine if the Rolling Stones stopped in the middle of their current tour and said, let's all now give a shout-out to Buddy Holly.
Yeah. A big man, physically and metaphorically, in life and in more so in death. Look at the numbers on this record that has been released 8 years after his death.
Yeah, it's closing in on platinum sales. It's well over 700,000 copies in the 4 weeks it's been out, and it's never left the top five of the Billboard charts. This is not, however, a new phenomenon, as we are fond of pointing out on Sound Opinions. It's always been the case that death is a great career move. That's one cliche that actually is true. Let's look, Greg, at some of the history of this.
Look at Elvis Presley. I mean, the man's been dead for, what, 3-plus decades? In 2005, the earnings in the Elvis Presley empire, $40 million. I mean, the guy is still selling records.
Extraordinary. Forbes magazine did a list of the top 13 posthumous earners, and Elvis Presley topped the list. Now, it's interesting when you put it in perspective. There's names on there like Charles M. Schulz. You know, the Peanuts cartoon is the whole cartoon empire, and Andy Warhol, and Dr. Seuss, and J.R.R. Tolkien, right? But the list is dominated by music figures. Elvis at number one, John Lennon at number three. You have George Harrison, made $7 million last year. Johnny Cash at number 10 made $7 million. Bob Marley trailing behind with Ray Charles at $6 million each. I mean, that's impressive.
The numbers are just ridiculous. I mean, franchises have been built around these figures, and you wonder how relevant they would have been had they just had the temerity to live. Yeah. You know, like, who would care? But at this point, Elvis was growing less, and remember, he was less and less interesting with every year that he was alive, and he's exploded in death. Ditto for Lennon, ditto for Harrison, ditto for the Marley franchise. We mentioned Tupac earlier in the context of the Biggie Smalls argument. Four albums in his lifetime, eight since he died, making money to the tune of $10, $12 million a year since Tupac Shakur's death for the Tupac Shakur estate.
Well, and this business gets ugly. Because there is so much money at stake, Greg, it gets really, really ugly. The Hendrix estate was tied up for years and years and years in court. In his lifetime, Jimi Hendrix had control over 2.5 studio albums. If you go to the record store today or you log on, you're going to see 40 or 50 or 60 for sale.
For sale, and not to mention the fact that there's probably been over 400 albums released in Hendrix's name. So when is this thing going to end? As soon as it stops paying off. And obviously, it's in no danger of doing that. This is a phenomenon that is never going away, and Biggie Smalls is the latest to cash in on it.
Well, let's play a track by Biggie. Like I said, this is pairing the dead Biggie, taking his vocals, and pairing them with live artists who came in and did stuff. I think this is a formula notably pioneered by the producers of Natalie Cole's record in 1991 when they paired her with her dead father. I mean, that's where this started. This is a track called Beef, and I think actually it's the best track on the album. It appeared originally on the first album he released, and now Diddy, his former partner, is coming in and adding to it, and they're saying that you don't know what beef is. You know, you rappers, you think you're beefing. Beefing is beefing in the street with guns. I mean, that's what took Biggie's life.
Right.
Beefing is bad. A little late for Biggie.
Bad boy. We still put my, you put your money where we singing. We reach the ceiling. Check it. My been top. This rap Alfred Hitchcock. Drop top notch. Player hit and don't stop. This instant. Rappers too persistent. Quick to spit. Biggie name on ish. Make my name taste like when you speak it. See me in the street. Your jewelry. You can keep it. That be our little secret. See me. B that is, I that is, G Wiz, motherfucker filling my biz. Don't they know my gotta flee or kidnap kids? Come in, they throw them over the bridge. That's how it is. My is laid out. Off that beat, ish, that is played out. Y'all got the goal. All I make is one phone call. All y'all disappear by tomorrow. All your is borrow. I don't feel sorrow. Actually, your man passed the to me. Now check this. What's beef? Beef is when you need to go to sleep. Beef is when your moms ain't safe up in the streets. Beef is when I see you. Guaranteed to be in ICU. One more time. What's beef?
All right. That was Beef from the new record of old songs by Biggie Smalls, the Notorious B.I.G. Duets, the final chapter, one of the biggest selling records in America right now. This is old stuff being refashioned with some big names. What's amazing about this record, Jim, is that Biggie is barely on some of these tracks.
There's two, in fact, where he's not on them at all.
The lead single, It Has Been Said, is the name of the song. Eminem's on there. Obie Trice is on there. P. Diddy's on there. But I don't hear Christopher Wallace's big booming baritone raps in there at all. And that's a single off the record.
Yeah, well, you know? He's on Nasty Where is Girl. That's been a hit. I got to say, though, as far as these posthumous cash-ins go, this one is of better quality than most. I think that the producers who come in, Jazzy Faye, you know, got this guy Reefa, you've got Andre Harris and Vidal Davis. I mean, they craft pretty cool tracks. And sometimes they're completely different than Biggie's music in his lifetime, mm-hmm. which were very, you know, kind of dark. And some of the cameos are pretty cool. You know, I mean, it's kind of interesting to compare Biggie's voice with Snoop's or with Eminem's. On the other hand, you have a track by new metal mavens Korn. Talk about being dead is bad enough, and then they're gonna pair you with Korn after you're gone.
The ultimate insult, or something.
You know. But I would say that this is a burn it record for curiosity reasons.
Oh, you're crazy. Come on. I mean, this is an insult. You know what this is, Jim? It's a bunch of guys jumping on this guy's tailcoats saying, we love you, we love you, Biggie. You're the most important hip-hop artist. I mean, at the time, they all wanted to knock this guy off. They hated him because he was so good. He was a rival. P. Diddy gets a page-long thanks
here. No, I know.
I mean, just, you know, slavishly sucking up to the legacy, the memory of the Notorious B.I.G. I wish he had spent as much time producing this record as he had put into writing that thank you.
I think one of the best things is that P. Diddy, his production isn't all over it, that there are some good, talented young producers. I'm not saying it's great. I'm not recommending spending cash money. But, you know, what the heck? It doesn't cost you anything to burn it.
Buy it, burn it, trash it. I say trash it and trash this whole phenomenon. I wish it would just go away.
Well, I agree. I agree. But I think this is better than a Tupac posthumous disc, don't you?
Well, you know, 8 Tupac posthumous releases is about 7.5 too many. and they were increasingly terrible as they came out. And I hope that well is dry. And I think now the Notorious B.I.G. well is dry. And I think that's the only hopeful note to be sounded out of this. Maybe this is over.
Yeah. Well, that and the fact that rappers still pay him homage on stage. Greg, God forbid, if you ever disappear, I will do the show each week. And I will give a shout out to my former partner up in heaven.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Each week on Sound Opinions, we go to the Desert Island. The Desert Island jukebox is being plugged in, the quarters being dropped in the slot. We come out with a record that we can't live without, at least for this day only. And this week, it is Jim DeRogatis' turn.
Well, Greg, I'm going to reference two of the pieces of music and artists we talked about earlier. One is Arctic Monkeys, and we said that one of the things we like about this band is that there's a kind of sharp-eyed observation, sociological observation, if you will, mm-hmm. of British society, at least as this young kid, Alex Turner, sees it. The other band that you mentioned was The Jam. The Jam covered the song I'm about to play, but they didn't write it. And I think probably the Arctic Monkeys think that the tradition of sociological observation and making witty cracks about the English society started with Pulp and Blur. However, the master of it is Ray Davies. The Kinks, from the beginning, were always looking at English society, peculularly English eccentricities, and writing great pop songs about them. And the song I'm going to play that The Jam covered is, of course, David Watts. This was a tune that kicked off Something Else by the Kinks, their 1967 album, and it's a priceless piece of Ray Davies sitting there being smarter and wittier than everyone else in England and remarking upon them. David Watts is a song where you have this guy saying, you know, I'm a dull and simple lad. I cannot tell water from champagne. I'm just a regular guy. And he goes on to really kind of sneer at this character, David Watts, who is a member of high society, obviously has some money, as we would have said in Jersey, thinks who he is, right? But it's interesting that one of the things that Davies takes shot at David Watts for is he is gay and fancy free. And I think that Davies is actually hinting around at the fact that David Watts might have been homosexual. Later in his career, Davies, of course, would write a brilliant pop song in loving homage to a transvestite, Lola. You know, I don't think he was actually anti-gay, but there is that undercurrent here. All the girls in the neighborhood try to go out with David Watts. They try their best, but they can't succeed, for he is of pure and noble breed. He's too good for Ray Davies, and Ray Davies is going to take issue with that. But it's also one of the great sing-along hooks of the Kinks' career. Fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa. You hear that once, you're hooked in. You just got to love it. And by the end of the 2.5-minute song, you're fa-fa-fine with Ray. So let's hear it. One of the all-time great Kinks songs, David Watts on Chicago Public Radio's Sound Opinions. Fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa. I could be like David Watts. Fa, 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 fa.
I could be like, wish I could be like, wish I could be like, wish I could be like, I wish I could show, show, show.
That was David Watts by the Kinks, Jim DeRogatis' Desert Island Jukebox pick. Nicely tying up the show. There was
a lot of disparate
threads all tied together
kind
there.
Kind of Curb Your Enthusiasm of us, wasn't it? We're bringing
exactly.
It up. What we got next week on Sound Opinions is our own unique rock and roll take on Valentine's Day.
The anti-Valentine's Day show, Love Stinks, the darkest, most disturbing love songs of all time. What a show it's going to be.
Well, and all this week, we're going to be taking your opinions. You can call in on our hotline, 888-859-1800. Give us your thoughts, or you can post on soundopinions.com at any time. We want to have some of your ideas about great anti-love songs. As always, we got some people to thank on the way out. Our executive producer, a man we do love, Mr. Tori Malatia. Todd Bachman is our managing producer and director. Matt Spiegel's our producer. Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn are our associate producers. We get a lot of engineering help from Eric Rudd and some technical assistance from Joe Dassault.
Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.